So we'll start off with asking, what's the definition of culture? What is culture anyway? Yes. The way we're taught to behave. I mean, most people in the West think about culture as whether you can distinguish, you know, Bach from Beethoven kind of thing. But this is a good start. Any other ideas? What is culture? Social affairs. Now this marker is running out on me. Yes. Customs according to a group of people. Lifestyle. Nice to see someone bring a baby. Prabhupada said we welcome first day babies in our Bhagavatam classes. A system for growth. What do you mean by that exactly?
Cultivation.
Okay. A way to communicate. I like that. Yes? Nourishment. My pen is running out. For body, mind, and soul. And this pen's running out. They're all my pens are running out. Yes? How to cope with the big question. I'm not sure if that's culture or not. I'm going to put a question mark on it. Part, maybe. Maybe. I'd put this more under philosophy and religion, so I'm going to put a question mark. I don't have any decent pens. Whoever's in charge of that kind of stuff. I could keep switching them, but they're all dead. Is there a lid somewhere? Okay, any other ideas? Yes. I'm sorry? The influence of thinkers in religions? I'm sure the influence of thinkers and religions. Okay, yes? Ah, definitely. Etiquette and behavior. Should I put a U there or not? Those of you who, you can, whatever you like. It's there or not there, depending on where you're from. Yes. Oh. Continuation of Su Samskaras. But he was saying something else there. Su Samskaras. Su. Auspicious. Okay. I'm looking for a couple others that I'm not getting. Yes. Art. That's generally what, that's kind of the trimmings. People think art, music. Something to identify people by. To identify and connect. Woo! I don't want to use another page, but I might have to. Yes? Ah, that's what I was looking for. Common set of values and symbols. Do we have a lid for this? Or it's not a bag. Okay. So I think we've got some good ideas there. There's the value symbols. I was looking also for norms. Do we have behaviors there? Way to communicate. Etiquette. But it goes beyond etiquette. Etiquette behavior. Okay. So I did some research as to what pretty extensive research, as to what Prabhupada meant when he used the word culture. Srila Prabhupada used the word culture quite a lot. Right? And what did Srila Prabhupada mean by that? And I'm going to read, it's not very long, a quote that is very typical of Prabhupada's use of the word culture. This is from Srimad Bhagavatam 1:17:24. But gradually, as the basic principles of Brahminical culture, namely austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness, became curtailed by proportionate development of pride, attachment for women, and intoxication, the path of salvation or the path of transcendental bliss retreated far, far away from human society. With the progression of the age of Kali, people are becoming very proud and attached to women and intoxication. By the influence of the age of Kali, even a pauper is proud of his penny. The women are always dressed in an overly attractive fashion to victimize the minds of men. And the man is attracted to drinking wine, smoking, drinking tea, and chewing tobacco, etc. All these habits, or so-called advancement of civilization, are the root causes of all religiosities. And therefore, it is not possible to check corruption, bribery, and nepotism. Do you all know what nepotism is? No. Nepotism is where you put someone in a position of authority, not because they're qualified, but because they're your friend or relative, or they gave some money to your political campaign, so you give them the position. Man cannot check all these evils simply by statutory acts and police vigilance, but he can cure the disease of the mind by the proper medicine, namely advocating the principles of Brahminical culture or the principles of austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. Modern civilization and economic development are creating a new situation of poverty and scarcity. It's interesting, he's saying modern economic development is creating poverty. With the result of blackmailing the consumers' commodities. If the leaders and the rich men of the society spend 50% of their accumulated wealth mercifully for the misled mass of people and educate them in God consciousness, the knowledge of the Bhagavatam, certainly the age of Kali will be defeated in its attempt to entrap the conditioned souls. We should always remember that false pride, or too high an estimation of one's own values of life, undue attachment to women or association with them, and intoxication, will divert human civilization from the path of peace, however much the people clamor for peace in the world. The preaching of the Bhagavatam principles will automatically render all men austere, clean both inside and outside, merciful to the suffering, and truthful in daily behavior. That is the way of correcting the flaws of human society, which are very prominently exhibited at the present moment. Now, is culture exactly the same as spiritual life? No. So, Prabhupada's talking about what here? And again, this quote typifies. You understand what typifies? Epitomizes. It's very, very typical if you research, if you type in culture into the database and you start looking up, which is what I did, and you just start looking up what did Prabhupada say about culture? What's in Prabhupada's purports about culture? So he's talking about what here primarily? Austerity, truthfulness, mercy, cleanliness. The four pillars of religion that following our four regulative principles are meant to counteract. And he's talking about what other kinds of things in relation to those. Values, right? Varna, education, good character, norms of behavior. At other places he'll also talk about etiquette. So all this is providing what? It's providing a foundation for spiritual life. It's not exactly spiritual life itself, but it's the foundation and the basis wherein spiritual life can flourish. Did Srila Prabhupada give a lot of emphasis to the transmission of the proper culture? I don't know about every day, but certainly a lot. certainly quite a lot. Now, if we want to consider, how is culture normally transmitted? How are values, norms of behavior, etiquette, the continuation of samskaras, and even the sort of, you know, the art and the culture and the music and the food and the sort of peripheral. Think about your own upbringing. And the fact that our culture was transmitted to us probably at a very young age. How was our culture transmitted to us? How are cultures transmitted? Now, I should say that I first developed this seminar because people would ask me, what is the most important thing that we can do to keep our children in the movement? And I used to answer with external things, such as, follow this ritual. I really like what you were saying, Mars, this morning about salvation and different ways of achieving salvation. You know, just this ritual, send your child to this kind of school. I was looking at very external things. And I found that, first of all, not everybody was able to do a lot of those things. And second of all, the people who had success didn't always do those things, and the people who did those things didn't always have success. And I started asking, why? And many, many years ago, Jagadish Prabhu asked me to research about various cultures in the world and how they transmitted their culture. He specifically was asking me to look in terms of vocation and marriage, but he was asking in general. He said, look at any culture that's different from the primary culture. What do they do? And I started finding that this applied not only to the children who were born and raised in our movement, but even to people who join, even to the new bhaktis and bhaktins. Why do some of them take up the cultures and the values and the norms of our society and some don't? How come some people stay with us for years and then they leave and again they buy a television and a dog? They go back to their old culture. Why do they do that? And why do other people imbibe the culture that Prabhupada is teaching us? Why do some people adopt the culture and some people don't? What was the deciding factor in culture? And I found some common threads that what was powerful. And I found that sometimes that we all know it. When we come to these three things, you're going to say, well, you know, I knew that. But it was, you'll see that it's not exactly probably what you thought at first. You might be surprised. I was surprised. So how is culture transmitted? How did you learn your own norms and values and behaviors from the culture in which you were raised or in Krishna consciousness? Yes. From example. Yes. From the adults around us. Can we also just say authority? Adults / authority? Education, formal education, like school? So this is informal education, but are you talking here formal education? So, formal. How is that, how does that get, how do people pick up on that? How do you learn that? How do you get those? Okay, from your parents. Yes? Peers and friends. From your wife? From your spouse and your family, we'll say. Wives are civilizing influence on men. I always knew that. Yes, it's a good influence. Oh, okay. Yes. Explain. Yes, what do you mean? That's what I thought you meant. So you do something wrong and you suffer from that. Be more specific. How do you suffer? Who makes you suffer? What makes you suffer? How do you learn the values and norms and the etiquette of your society by suffering by experience? What causes that suffering? Your wife. I have to talk to Keshava about this. But actually, Shana Kapoor was very close on track. What causes the suffering? When you violate the norms and behaviors and etiquette of your society and you suffer, where does that suffering come from? What kind of suffering is that? Punishment from where? Where does it come from? How do you know you've done something wrong? But what specifically? Well, but that's not exactly culture. That's the legal rules of society. It's not exactly your culture. But that's not your culture. That's not your culture. Super souls, that's not your individual culture. That's not your culture. Your culture. The culture that you're in. How do you learn that ethos? You get love or you... Oh! Thank you. Yes. So, I mean, you're really on track there. You've got something. Just keep going with it. So you make mistakes. You do something against the values and the norms of your culture. And you get some reaction. Where does that reaction come from? Other people. What do? Okay. They go, what are you doing? Yeah, but it's not, I mean, but it's disapproval and approval, right. Okay, they associate or not associate with you. It usually isn't reward and punishment. You don't usually get put in jail or something. I mean, maybe you get a certificate, or maybe you get shunned. I mean, it has to be pretty extreme, but yes. Oh, this is a great group. I've taught this many times. You are the best group I have ever taught this to. Yeah. Save me. Yes, you may get, and we'll get to a minute on, so Ananda Vrindavan was bringing up a good point. You may get disapproval from your parents, but approval from your friends. All right, so we're coming closer and closer to something that's very important here. So what determines, one of our most important things that determine the transmission of culture. And what's nice is if I have a big board and you can see this and the next thing I'm going to do. So those of you who have a good visual memory, just remember this. And those of you who don't, I'm sorry. Oh. You have little sticky tack stuff? Okay. We won't ruin the paint. But then I have to be competent, too. Sorry. So the first thing is getting the approval or disapproval of people. What kind of people? Yeah. These are people, you have to feel what about these people? You have to trust that these people, what about you? Is an official relationship enough? The fact that the person has the title parent, is that good enough? No, it has. There has to be. There has to be some bond of love, of trust, right? In Vedic culture, that person was the parent and also the teacher, the guru. But is just having the title of guru? If we think that somebody cares about us, then we're willing to do anything to please that person. We will mold ourselves. We'll behave in ways that they like, and we won't behave in ways that they don't like. So what you were saying, that your parents may not approve, but your friends may approve. Or it may be the other way. It depends who you're closer to. Who are you going to please, your parents or your friends? Well, who do you trust more? Who are you closer to? Whose approval means more to you? Right? That's the question. Someone brought up example. Someone always brings up example. Is example enough? No. We'll follow the example of somebody we trust. I mean, suppose I say to you, you have to do this. Will you do it? Maybe. Well, if I have power over you, you'll do it temporarily out of fear until you can get back at me. Otherwise, you'll do it only if you trust me. Otherwise, you'll ignore me. So just giving people instructions, this is right, this is wrong, this is our culture, this is our values, is that useful? Not very. Unless you have a relationship of trust with somebody. Now, example is very interesting. I read a sociological study of Indian villages in about the 1940s where children were taught entirely by example and one other method, which I'll get to in a minute. Children were not given practically any direct instruction like you should do this, this is right, this is wrong. Practically none. And children learn mostly by imitation. Those of you who have children work with children. Children imitate everything, especially until they're about five. Everything. So these children imbibed the culture of their families because they only saw one kind of example. There was no media. There was only travel by ox cart. And they never left their village. Maybe they went to the neighboring village. And everybody set the same kind of example. They only saw one kind of example. They never saw a counterexample, ever. If anyone in the village behaved differently, you know, they were out. It was very tightly socially controlled. And I still meet people from these traditional cultures, like India, like China, who say to me, Romila, we just have to set an example. Does this work anymore? And the people from these cultures do not understand why just setting an example isn't working anymore. They're losing their children like crazy. Does it work in our temples? If people come and join the movement and all we're doing is setting an example, are people going to take up our culture? First of all, does everyone in the temple set a consistently good example? Of course, right? But let's say, of course we do. All the time, all of us. Especially me, all the time. Yes. But even let's say that all of us set a perfect example all of the time. Actually, my daughter-in-law's parents once asked Srila Prabhupada, what's the best way to preach? My daughter-in-law's mother just went to Vrindavan to give up her body. But they asked Srila Prabhupada, what is the best way to preach? Prabhupada told them, you invite someone to your house for 3 days, and after they live with you for 3 days, you say to them, now you do what I have done, what I do. So how many of us set such an example that we could do that? But let's say that everybody in the temple and in ISKCON set a perfect example. Would that be enough? No. First of all, we don't. There are good examples and bad examples. People are going to see mixed examples. But we are not going to follow simply examples. And then there's so much outside society. People are going to be always exposed to bad examples in the outside society. We're not an insulated society. There has to be at least one, there must be at least one person, at least one person that we think, I want to please this person. I care what this person thinks about me. I want to behave a certain way. I want to have certain values. I want to follow certain etiquette. Because otherwise this person will not like me. And if I follow these things, this person will like me. And I care. All right. The next thing, which was the other main way that traditional societies transmitted culture, and which many of you brought up, many of you talked about, some of you talked about, and I'm sure everybody would have mentioned it sooner or later, was the media. What's the main content of the media? Don't think specifically, think generally. What's the media made up of? Okay, but even advertisements is in the form of, what's the form? Television is, okay, there's television. What's the form? No, it's not information. But what form is it in? What form? What's the form? Think, how do traditional societies transmit culture? It's being done. Television is doing it the same way. Yeah, stories. Even advertisement is often a little story. Stories. Even most songs are stories. I loved her. She left me. I'm crying. It's a little story. Right? Stories. Now, I also do an hour and a half seminar just on stories. How you can tell stories and how you can devise metaphors. What's the Bhagavatam full of? Stories. All the philosophy in the Bhagavatam is interwoven into stories. What was a lot of Srila Prabhupada's teaching was in the form of stories. Do the stories have to be factual stories? Even a little analogy is a kind of a story. A very small analogy is a little story. Hey? Who's one of the most expert storytellers in the Bhagavatam? Oh, yes, definitely. But we have an incredible preacher in the Bhagavatam. Absolutely incredible. He can preach to anybody through stories. Narada Muni, greatest storyteller. Of course, he gets people's attention first. My dear Purchini Barishat, I just see in the sky the animals you have sacrificed are now appearing with horns to attack you. And I have this nice story I'd like to tell you. There was once a man looking for a suitable home, and he was traveling all over the universe. Then he found this nice city with 9 gates. Of course, he has nothing to do with you. Yes. Okay. Well, in Prabhupada's saying we're not storytellers, we're philosophers. In other words, we're not telling myths. Prabhupada was very interested in separating what we're doing from people talking about Krishna as a myth. So sometimes Srila Prabhupada used the word story with the meaning of myth. One thing to keep in mind is that Prabhupada used very old British English and sometimes the meaning that he has. So if you don't like the word story, we'll use the word narrative. Is that right? You don't like that? Okay? Abby? Okay. Okay. So, why are narratives so powerful? They're entertaining. They involve the emotions. People relate to them. You got it. Bingo. Doesn't affect the false ego. Completely circumvents the false ego. You don't even know you're being preached to. You just think you're being entertained. You don't even know the person's talking about you. Do you know that some of the most powerful preachers in our movement are those who tell lots and lots of narratives? Right? I mean, I don't have time right now, but there's a science as to how to create your own allegory and metaphor for the specific problem that you're dealing with when preaching to somebody. I mean, I was at one temple where the temple president said to me, Urmila, I really have this problem with two women who were envious of each other. I mean, that doesn't happen very often, but occasionally. He asked me if I could help. So I thought, well, I don't know if we can do anything about this. One woman was running a project, and then the other woman came on the scene, and they were fighting over who was going to be in charge. So I had to be in the car with one of the ladies. We were driving to a preaching program. And I just said to her, well, there were these two people in the boat, and they had to get across the river. And one was rowing one way, and one was rowing the other way. And so they kept going in circles, and you know, here and there. And then they sort of looked at each other and said, you know, if we just rowed in concert, we'd get across the river faster. And they said, yeah. It would be an awfully good idea. And they just started rowing together and they got across the river very quickly. And after that, they just rowed together wherever they went. We just talked about other things. And after that, the two ladies got along, at least for a while. And I never told her what it was about. Many times, analogies and metaphors can have the result of changing someone's consciousness without ever even explaining them. I've also noticed that when you tell stories, your audience changes. They all get very quiet. And people almost go into a trance when you tell a story. It bypasses the false ego. I mean, scientifically, you can show when you tell stories, people's minds actually go into alpha, generally. It has a very different effect. People take on the values of the culture just naturally and automatically, which should show you the danger of the media. Stories, narratives, they're one of the most powerful means of transmitting culture. Because you take on values and attitudes and norms of behavior naturally and unconsciously. It bypasses this accepting, rejecting of the mind. You just make it a part of yourself. You want to transform someone effortlessly and easily, tell them a narrative. I mean, think for a minute. It wasn't that long ago that abortion was not accepted or the idea of homosexuals being married was not accepted. It was completely unaccepted. It was inconceivable. Why are these things now accepted? How did that happen? You can say through the media, but what did the media, what did they do? Did someone get up and explain what an abortion is? And no, they told some story. This poor girl got raped. And she did. She couldn't raise the baby. And then she had an abortion. And then she was so happy. You know, or they tell the story. Here's this nice homosexual couple, and they're nice, upright members of society. And then they got married, and they're living like everybody else. And see, that's how they do it. It's a story. If they try to logically explain, now let's discuss, what's the purpose of marriage? What is marriage for? How is it described in the scriptures? Then nobody would accept. If you discussed it intellectually and logically, but if you tell it as a story, people will say, well, sure, that makes sense. I was speaking with Nagaraj Prabhu, who's our editor of Back to Godhead, and I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could have some movies about, you know, Ramayana and Mahabharata and Srimad Bhagavatam that could be as popular as these other, you know, fantasy movies like they make. Star Wars and was the big one, like Lord of the Rings or whatever it is. And he said, you know, that would be nice, but it would be better if there were shows about the Hare Krishna family next door, who's very wise, or the traveling Hare Krishna monk that I know, who answers all my questions. He said, some stories like that would do more to change people's attitude towards Krishna consciousness. And I thought, you know, he's right. If you gradually infiltrated the media with these kind of narratives. And I've seen children who had very little contact with the process of devotional service except for those two things and ended up deciding they wanted to be first-class fixed-up devotees. They heard lots and 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 lots of stories about Krishna. And they had some deep contact of trust with some devotee that they really cared about. And they said, I really want to dedicate myself to Krishna consciousness. Now, this last one, this is something you all know, and I'm sure that nobody thought of this one. And I also give a whole seminar on this. What's that? Sometimes it's called anchors, for those of you who've ever studied psychology. So, you ever have a particular smell, place, word, taste that makes you relive an experience, either positive or negative? Everyone's had that experience? Some certain food, some certain smell, some person, some set of words, some place. And as soon as you're there, you immediately, it triggers that smell, that place, that event triggers a physiological state. It's not a memory. You relive that experience in your mind and body. It's such a strong association that it triggers a physiological state. State. So I'll give you two examples. We used to live in Detroit and we would shop in Canada. And one time I was shopping there with my daughter. I said, do you want to come in the store or wait in the car? She said, I'll wait in the car. And while I was shopping, I came back out and she said, Mats, I was so scared. There was some man walking in the parking lot and I thought he was a kidnapper. So after that, she said, anytime she heard Canada, she felt fear. I apologize to any of you who are in Canada. But Canada became a trigger for her for being afraid. So a trigger can happen with one strong event, either positive or negative. When I was growing up, my father would wake up every morning at 5 o'clock, and he would wake me up also about 5 or 5:30. From the time I was 2 until I went to the university at 17, I would spend 1 to 2.5 hours every morning with my father. And when I was little, he would play games with me. He always made my breakfast. My mother would sleep late. And he would teach me actually about like morals and ethics. And we would just spend time together. And my father and I were very, very close. We were very, very good friends. And I always associate the early morning hours with a sense of security and love and just happiness. So now that wasn't one event, but it was repeated over time. So a trigger can be established either with one strong event, positive or negative, or with something repeated. So this is also how culture is transmitted. By associating strong positive or negative emotional experiences with certain events or places or things. I see that we have children who don't like, for example, to chant japa because they were treated very harshly during japa time. And even the children in our movement who had very bad experiences in Krishna consciousness, almost all of them like kirtan. So I was wondering, why do they all like kirtan? Any idea why? Exactly. It's the only time they were free. It became a very strong positive trigger for them. So we should consider, those of you who are dealing with children, you should consider, or even with adults, to avoid setting up a negative trigger. There's an offense, for example, to chastise anyone in front of the deity. Obviously, it's disturbing to Krishna to hear you yelling at somebody in front of him. But also, just imagine what kind of a negative trigger you may be setting up in somebody with the kirtan, with the temple room, etc. If you have to do something negative, please do it outside the temple room, if possible, outside of the morning program. People should associate the basic aspects of Krishna consciousness with some strong positive experience. Whatever negative things we have to do, we should do them outside of at least our basic practices. So that's the summary. And I wanted to leave. I know we've been participating all this time, but I also wanted to have some time just for discussion and questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Omela, for your lecture. I found it very valuable. Could you maybe be so kind to just go with us through these three points: approval or not of people who are close to you, narratives, and these triggers, how they can be more implied in our own Hare Krishna movement or Hare Krishna culture. I think it would be very valuable if we as individuals who can transmit a culture hear a little bit how to apply them in the context of ISKCON and then become agents for transformation, maybe, so that we can help the devotees to find peace and happiness in our own culture.
Well, first of all, we should realize that just the fact that people who come to the movement have an official relationship with other devotees does not mean that that first relationship exists. Just because there's a temple president or even a spiritual master does not mean that there's somebody who really loves and cares about that devotee. And Peter Burwash gave a seminar recently in New Vrindavan. Does everyone know who Peter Burwash is? He's been a devotee for many, many years. He met Prabhupada many times. He never became initiated because he said he couldn't chant more than 8 rounds a day, but he's been following the regulative... He's been following the regulative principles and chanting 8 rounds now for, I don't know, 35, 37 years. And he met Prabhupada many, many times. Prabhupada asked him to preach about vegetarianism. He's very successful in his business. And he said that in the last year that he visited 44 temples, and in only 2 temples did anybody come up to him and say, "Hello, my name is, what's your name?" Two out of 44. He said devotees would just, you know, walk past him, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, you know. So we don't even say hello to people. Now he's very wealthy, he's very famous. We don't even say hello. The first thing we should do is make sure that there's at least one person for all the devotees that loves that person that they can trust. Again, an official relationship isn't enough. That there's a temple president, that there's a GBC, even that there's a guru. I mean, maybe they see their guru once a year for an hour. That may not be enough. Those relationships have to be there. I mean, each of us should think, is there anybody who feels that way about me? Is there anyone who feels that they really want to please me? That my opinion about their behavior matters? That they would stop and say, you know, if I behave like that, will they be upset with me or will they be pleased with me? And do I have someone like that in my life that I want to please? Are we establishing those relationships? As far as narratives, you know, when I'm trying to help someone, do I immediately just say, look, this is the philosophy. Why aren't you following it? This is the way you ought to behave. You know, what are you in Maya? Or am I creative? I mean, sometimes we should be creative. Srila Prabhupada used so many analogies in his preaching. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati used so many analogies. Why? Not just to make things clearer, believe me. There's a reason. There's a reason why all the acharyas preach in narratives. It is powerful. There's a reason why the philosophy is interwoven into narrative. There's power in narrative. And if you even think about Leela, you know, within the Leela, there's you can say that there's the transcendent Trinvatana Swakata Krishna. But there's also the culture is being transmitted, isn't it? How are the personalities behaving with each other? What kind of etiquette? You know, Krishna's offering obeisances to Yudhisthira, he's embracing Arjuna, he's offered obeisances by Nakul and Sahadev. One example, even in the Leela of culture, when I was just recently in Slovenia and Croatia, people were talking about the concept of helping the children find suitable spouses. And I was speaking about having what I've come to call arranged introductions, where the parents say, all right, I'm looking for someone suitable for you. And then they introduce them, not arranged marriage, where they just say, okay, tomorrow you're marrying somebody, whether you like it or not. But in other words, where the parents are assisting, and many of the devotees there said, well, will your children accept that? And one reason they will accept that is if they've been brought up their whole life hearing those kind of stories. If they've been brought up their whole life with the media seeing a slightly different kind of story, shall we say, then maybe they won't accept that. And what kind of narratives are they being exposed to? So how do we preach to people? You know, do we always hit them over the head? And then we wonder, you know, why. And then when they don't take it, we just say, oh, they're just in Maya anyway. And another use of that is understanding, again, the danger of narratives from outside. Then as far as triggers, we should know, you know, what are the long-term effects of mixing something negative with our process of Krishna consciousness. What are we doing? What are we doing if I yell at someone in the middle of their japa? Besides just interrupting their japa, which is not very respectful. What else might I be doing? What might I be setting up for them? What about the atmosphere where they chant? What is the room like? You understand? I mean, I'll just say frankly, this is a hard thing to say, but I'll say frankly, you know, just like there were many years where the ladies were not allowed to chant in the temple room, and the ladies with children were not allowed to chant where the ladies were allowed to chant. So the ladies with children were given, you know, we were usually given the garage. So we were given a place that was usually cold and dirty. And very honestly, that's one reason why a lot of the grihasthas stopped coming to the temple. So one should be thinking like that. What association am I setting up here? Is it positive or negative in people's minds? Are people going to get it? Again, triggers are set up either repeated over time or through one strong thing. As soon as a person comes to the temple, are they going to get it overwhelming? Oh, yes, the temple. As soon as I come to the temple, I think, what? What kind of thing will that revive for them? What impressions are we creating for people? Because we are. Is that...
Is it necessary to systematically institute trauma therapy in ISKCON?
What kind of therapy?
Trauma therapy. You were speaking about triggers, and this immediately triggers me to think of...
I hope not. We should probably systematically institute training and chanting very nicely without offense as our trauma therapy. And
so you're recommending a positive approach of creating a nice atmosphere and preventing traumas. But what about family members or devotees who gave up Krishna consciousness because they combine their experience with negative triggers?
We should certainly have some help for that. I mean, we certainly have more and more devotees in the movement now who are trained. I mean, it's interesting with that. And one thing with triggers, I tell married couples, if you're angry, don't look at each other's face when you're angry. No, seriously. Then you'll associate your spouse's face with that feeling of anger. And there's a way to solve that. What you do is you think about, you actually mentally, internally relive some time when you felt very loving, and then you look at the other's face and you set up a new kind of trigger. So these things, yes, they can be solved. And we should all work at healing. Certainly healing, I don't know if it's through trauma therapy or whatever. That's another discussion. But it would be certainly better to work at forms of healing rather than condemnation. It's very easy to condemn people. Cheap, fast. Oh, they're all nonsense. Throw them away. If that was Krishna's policy, we'd all stay merged in the body of Mahavishnu forever. Krishna goes to a lot of trouble to reclaim us. A lot. So, but there should be compassion. Should be compassion. Exactly how it should be done. Maybe some people need trauma therapy. I don't know. I don't think that should be our general modus operandi. But perhaps for some people, that's fine.
When you listed these three kinds of ways to transmit the culture, Didn't mean to say that this is the main ways to transmit the culture. Other ways are not very important. How I would like to know how complete this list is, according
thank you.
To your
thank you.
Investigation.
These are the most powerful. If these three are existent, or even one of them very strongly, then a person may adopt that culture that's being transmitted, even if other things are not so existent. If a person has a very, very strong positive experience with a particular set of values, they may adopt that culture, even if that's the only thing that's... If a person is strongly exposed to the narratives of the culture, they're going to imbibe those values, even if that's all that's there. And if a person has just one strong relationship of trust with even one other person, they may imbibe those values in that culture, even if that's all that's there. And if those three things are there, they'll probably imbibe that culture. Now, other things are helpful. Without any of those things, the chances that they'll imbibe that culture, then you'd have to have some sort of very insulated environment, like I was describing, which doesn't exist so much anymore. If you had an extremely insulated environment where the only thing a person was exposed to was a particular set of values and they had no chance to find out any other values, then perhaps it could operate without that. But even in those insulated environments, they relied strongly on narratives. They relied strongly on narratives and example, and to some extent on triggers also. They didn't have to so much depend upon trust because the people didn't have an option. They could rely more on fear or just habit. But as soon as a lot of those people, if they were then exposed to something outside, they would sometimes leave. That I believe that the person cares about me. That the opinions of this person or group of persons are extremely important to me. I may be wrong. I may wrongly trust. My trust may be entirely misplaced, yes.
Just always be searching the trust.
Oh, yeah.
The way to reach the final.
I mean, many, many times a person will change their values and behaviors to try to please people who are not worthy of it. Happens all the time. It happens all the time. When people, let's say a person sends their children to the outside schools and has them watch television. So the children may think, I want to please my friends at school because these friends really care about me. The friends may not care about them, but they're thinking like
that. But what I feel and understand, because I brought up in different system, so might be my understanding is not clear about it, that as I understand in the Western world, we have tendency let them allow to experience their life and grow them and let them do whatever they want and make their way, find their sources. So from the beginning, the life goes like that. People trying and trusting and failure, trying, trusting and failure, trying, trusting and failure. And when we go in the Vedic concept and Vedic culture and on the traditional basis of understanding these things, then are there any fundamental difference in follow-up that we have to always try and trust and fail and trust and fail and trust and fail? Or there is some another fundamental point in your researches you find out that which can implement to explain the traditional way or the Vedic way or somewhere in that it have some another meaning about it? Because that does not, like trusting and experiencing, trusting and failing and going on, that can be whole life, can be not able to develop the relation. And then if no relation, nobody want to hear the narration, and nobody want to hear the narration, then very hard to trigger.
Well, I'm not suggesting that we do that. I mean, that's not my suggestion. And it's not that everyone in the West follows that model. I mean, there's many subcultures in the West. It's not all one homogeneous culture. And there are many parents who just say, yes, go out and find somebody, and then there's trusting and failing and trusting and failing and trusting and failing. But it's not always like that. And the other thing is that in the West, many times, people don't lose faith. They end up trusting the wrong people their whole life, and they never figure out that they've trusted the wrong people. They're molding their life, their whole life, after their particular Western values, thinking that by pleasing this set of people, they're going to become happy, and they don't give up that trust. So that's not always the case. And I see that the same principle operates in the West, that people, they're molding their values by the people that they trust. It's usually their family, their friends, the people at work, sometimes their government, the people in society. Sometimes the specific people may change, but they have a set of people that they feel, I want to please these people. The values and the norms of these people are important to me. I want to become like these people. And whether that's true, I mean, sometimes this is foolishly done. Often it's foolishly done. A person may be trying to please gang members, you know. But the principle is the same. Whether it's happening in a traditional way and you're pleasing the right persons, or whether it's happening and you're pleasing the wrong persons, we mold ourselves like that. We want to talk, we want to dress, we want to have etiquette, we want to have values, according to, except for a few rare sociopaths, some people with like a mental sociological disease, a few exceptions. But generally people want to mold themselves after that. Some group of people. Yes, sometimes people will change. They'll say, oh, now I want to follow this group of people. Now I want to follow this group of people. Now I want to follow this group. But generally, that's not the case. Generally, even in the West, that's not the case. There's a general set of cultural norms and behaviors that people adopt and follow. And that's... There is an overall reinforcement from the society and from the narratives they get from the television, from the radio, from the newspaper, from the magazines, as to what's acceptable in their society. So that the basic principle is operating. It's just that we in the Hare Krishna movement would say that the kind of people that you're trying to please in the West are not trustworthy. The narratives that are being propagated in the media and in the books and so forth, the values they're giving are contrary to that which will help you develop as a proper human being. They're not going to provide the foundation for spiritual life. The sort of activities in which you're having your positive emotional experiences are harmful to you. But the principles are still operating. They're operating in ways that are hurting you. But the principles are still there. Does that make sense?
Thank you very much.
Yes, Mom.
I must confess that I'm both a story lover and a storyteller. And I wanted to ask you, what are the main, the main points or main... things to watch when you want to tell a good story. What are the main principles here which help that the story comes into the mind of your listener and stays there? I'm sorry, but I'm very pragmatic, and I'm getting here in these seminars always good ammunition. So thank you for going to your memory bank.
was why I asked you that question about simplicity. I was thinking, is it better to have a simple life without my computer? Better to have my computer, be able to give my seminar about Prabhupada with this kind of interactive, and then I have to bring my computer and my disk and have them hook up a projector. And, we're helping someone to discover their own answers. That they're non-threatening, they're fully engaging. They foster someone's independence. They bypass conscious resistance. And they're a model of flexibility. Okay, they have to meet the conditions of a well-formed plan, which means that you have to help people find a solution that's positive and under their control. This is to create your own story, to create your own metaphor and analogy. That you want to come up with a solution that has specific behavior and context. In other words, some solution that's specific as to thinking, feeling, and willing, and specific behavior, and that's compatible with their goals. But it's best if your metaphor creates a bridge to a solution, but not the solution itself. So if the person you're telling the story to will actually generate their own ultimate solution. And there's two methods. And one is that you access the other person's present situation physically. That you actually, to some extent, imitate in your own body and mind what the solution for their problem would be. And kind of go back and forth from their problem to their solution, and then spontaneously the metaphor will come to mind. That's more from the spontaneous mind than creative. I've been through exercises to do that, but I don't think so. The other one is a step-by-step process, which is where you pick out, decide who the characters are. Someone tells you we're having a problem with this and this situation. You decide, okay, we're dealing with person A, person B, this situation, this character. And then you change the context of the situation. Like I changed the temple management to a river, and the particular project to a railroad. And pick something that both of you are familiar with. And then you create characters in the new context, but you preserve the relationship. So I created two people in the logo, but they had the same relationship because they were both managing the same project. And if possible, identify the recipient's both present and ideal situation, whether it's a physical situation, mental and intellectual situation, or emotional situation, or all three. So what ideal situation would they be in, physically, mentally, intellectually, emotionally, and then some bridge between the two situations. So the situation they were in right now was that they were rolling in circles, and the ideal situation is that they were rolling anonymously. Now you notice I didn't tell this lady how to do that. I didn't tell her specifically how to get along with each other so they could row together. I just suggested that, okay, now you figure it out, if you row together, you're going to get to the other side. Then how do you deliver the metaphor? some great techniques, and I found this really interesting because this is done all over the Shastra. Put it in quotes. You know, somebody told me this story. I mean, all through the Bhagavatam, someone said that Pancha Tantra is also like that. Someone said that. Or having another story, a story that's embedded within a story, within a story, within a story, layers of stories. Also put in presuppositions. A presupposition is where there's assumptions built in that the story would only work if you're assuming certain things to be true. You can also, this is a little complex before I say two things. You can also subtly embed messages by shifting tone of voice. Make sure that you're in rapport with the other person by having harmony of body language and tone of voice. And right after you're done with the story, immediately change the subject to break the first person's concentration. Incorporate into the story information the person tells you while you're talking. Incorporate into the story information the person has told you. Is it super strict? And if I go over by 5 minutes, do I get through that?
Yes.
Sorry. Boy, I'm really getting in trouble from all angles. I'm sorry. Am I violating the norms here? I'm violating your trust? Uh-oh. I'm going to come in with a bat. Now I'm really in trouble, huh? I'm trying to see if I have a nice... What I might be able to do is print out the handout for you. I'll see if I can get some... If I can get a... Would I be able to get a connection with the printer here somewhere? Okay, so maybe I can do that. Can I answer another question or am I dead? A minute. I'm allowed 1 minute. Okay, forget it. Okay, how many I'll take because then I don't have to answer. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I just felt like, as I studied sociology before, that the main trigger is like R.D. Lange did this sociology study about family, saying that if there's no culture, if there isn't a family. So, mainly he was probably studying single parents. So for me, if you don't, you have those three, but if you don't have a family, you can't have those three. Yeah. Because you might have a single parent, but that you might have trust, but then you don't have a father figure or a female figure to have any morals or norms. And that's what he studied, like if a child was born without parents, how on earth is he going to develop culture or she? So.
It's possible with extended family and community. It's not impossible. I mean, if those things are all operating, then we wouldn't have so much breakup of the family if these were operating in a positive way. Yeah. But if we start building our own proper culture, then we'll start having a stable society.
Because I suppose being brought up in the Western society, like where I come from, England, it's like the elderly parents, extended family, aren't part of the proper family anymore. They were pushed away in some nursing home.
Well, I see that Western culture is definitely being transmitted. It's not that there's no culture being transmitted in the West. The question is, what culture is being transmitted in the West? There is some kind of norms and behaviors and values that's being transmitted in the West. It's not that there's nothing being transmitted. There is something. And in fact, it is those norms and behaviors that's being transmitted in the West that is causing the breakup of the family. Okay, I think if I don't stop now, then I won't be fed, I guess, for the rest of the time. Or. And Maharaj also has a question. I mean, what should I do? I mean, you're the boss. What should I do? Just stop now? Okay, yes. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.